Now getting into side B, which is the evolution of women in sci-fi. This is something that we've been kind of like trying to plan for most of the hiatus.
It's planning really poorly.
But I mean, sci-fi, if you think about this genre, it's considered a man's genre, and specifically like a nerdy guy who can't talk to girls kind of genre. And yet it was originated by a woman, and some of the most revolutionary parts of it were created or exemplified by women. And so we wanted to discuss that, some of the major like watershed moments in sci-fi fandom history. But first, you wanted to start with first memory. So like, what was your first memory or experience with the sci-fi genre? Like, what got you into sci-fi growing up?
You go first, May, and then I will go. Okay. And then Jessica.
Okay, well, one of my first experiences watching sci-fi was with my dad. He was obsessed with Star Trek, the original series, and he still is. He still watches all three seasons on Netflix. Whenever I see him, that's what he's watching. but not as much Star Trek The Next Generation, although he did watch the whole series. And I just recall like watching a few episodes specifically that registered in my mind. And he loved throwing out random facts or trivia and cast information, so that's where I get it from. And I also used to watch the 60s Batman TV show with him, and then later I really became got really into Batman the Animated Series. Hercules and Xena, Warrior Princess, were also a staple of my childhood, as well as Lois and Clark, The New Adventures of Superman, every Sunday. And interestingly, he did not like Star Wars that much, so I did not grow up watching that at all, and I didn't see any of the movies until adulthood. But those were like my primary things I watched as a kid. My intro to sci-fi.
Oh, very nice. Your intro to sci-fi? Yes. Sci-fi 101? First, we're kind of covering, like, it's sci-fi, but we're also talking supernatural, action,
fantasy,
you know, science-oriented action, fantasy, yeah, because it all goes back to sci-fi. It's just, like, a different way of looking at science, right? Because the line between technology and magic or something, there's a quote about it. You guys know what I'm talking about. That technology so advances indistinguishable from magic. There we go. That's what it is. Okay, moving on. My personal experience, my first contact with sci-fi genre was actually through anime. So specifically, series like Saber Marionette J, Cowboy Bebop, Neon Genesis Evangelion, and my favorite one's Sailor Moon, but that's just Magical Girl. So Saber Marionette was like my favorite of those, and I thought it was a particularly interesting case for today's topic, specifically because the entire series is predicated on the question of what a future would be like without women. So the last woman died out in some like space exploration, so it's just men that were left. And then they have to, like, recreate New Earth. It's like Terra, like New Terra or whatever is what it's called. And they create fantasy versions of women, right, that are like robots, the marionettes, and that replace most of their needs, except they can't reproduce. So everyone is a clone, and everyone is a clone of a dude. So it's a very weird show because it's, like, you're watching for the whole first season. It's the three main characters are marionettes, and it's, like, how they react to the men and how the men react to them and like see them as women, but not, right? They're less than human, which is just how men see women anyway, even if they were human. But it's also like, what's the difference between between being human and being a robot, as well as what's the difference between how men see women and how women really are? Because there does end up being a woman who survived, and then it's like, surprise, bitch! And then suddenly we get real women, at least in the form of clones, in later seasons. And then you have that whole extra layer of the fact that the creator of the story, Satoru Akahori, is a man. So it's still how a man views women, even though the story is about the difference between how men view women and how women are. So, wow. Anyway, my first experience with American science fiction, or more mainstream science fiction, if you want to call it, is a little bit embarrassing. Because, I mean, it is Star Wars. But the reason that I first saw anything Star Wars was because my friend Amber and I had watched Life as a House and fell in love with Hayden Christensen in that movie. And on the cover of that DVD, because we bought it as a DVD and we put it in, it's like, you can see Hayden Christensen in Star Wars Episode 2, you know, that's coming out soon. So we're like, oh, we have to watch Star Wars Episode 2. And so that was the first movie, the Star Wars movie, that I saw for Hayden Christensen, and we saw it like 10 times in the movie theaters because we loved Hayden Christensen that much, even though it was garbage. And so then, before episode 3 came out. I'm like, I should know what Star Wars is actually about. So then went and watched all the Star Wars movies so far, started reading, you know, the expanded universe, and now I know all the Star Wars stuff, and I've read fanfics and whatnot, right? I don't know all the Star Wars stuff. I'm not at that level. I know a decent amount of Star Wars stuff.
I know things.
I know things, yes.
Is that all your memories?
Those are all my Star Wars. That's my sci-fi experience.
Well, I'm realizing that I left some stuff out, because I left out some genres, but thinking back on my experience with sci-fi growing up, a lot of my interaction with the genre came from bonding with my dad. So he liked Star Wars and Star Trek. He wasn't like a Trekkie or, you know, whatever you call a Star Wars fan, a Borgie, I don't know what you call them, but he did watch a lot of those shows and films, so we watched a lot of them together. I remember a lot of the shows usually came on Saturdays, like in the middle of the day. So like Highlander, Hercules, Xena, they all came on around the same time on the EPN, the WB, or whatever they was calling itself at that time. So we watched them together. We watched Star Trek together. Stargate SG-1 came on over the weekends, and so I watched that. All those shows were shows that I watched with my dad, so that's like my strongest connection to that kind of like sci-fi fantasy genre. With anime, like, growing up, Sailor Moon, of course, Dragon Ball Z, like, a lot of those came on before I got to go to school. So I watched that. Samurai Pizza Cats was a cute one. Cardcaptor Sakura. My first, like, real, like, mature themed anime, Cowboy Bebop, was, still one of my favorites. What else? Ghost in the Shell, Neon Genesis Evangelion. I can't think of it right now. Gundam Wing.
Oh, yeah, Gundam Wing, yeah. I watched that one, too.
A lot of those. So, like, a lot of those, like, growing up. And then, of course, all of the DC comics. And I also watched, the only thing Marvel I think I watched was, like, X-Men. But, you know, with DC, like, Young Justice, Batman the Animated Series. A lot of those, you know, like, all, like, Saturday morning cartoons. Like, a lot of that was part of my childhood growing up, and kind of like really connected me to the genre. So yeah, that's my introduction of like sci-fi and fantasy and comics in like a nutshell. I wasn't really so much into like the comics, like reading the comics as much as I was into, I got my first introduction through like the animated series version and all that kind of stuff. But for the genre itself, the mother of sci-fi is actually Mary Shelley, you know, the author of Frankenstein.
The real lady with Dumption of the Week.
The real lady with Dumption. Tati, did you want to...
Yes, sure. I was going to give y'all, like, her entire fucking biography, but...
I see that.
I feel like it's not totally necessary. We can just say she was married to romantic poet Percy Shelley, and then they were just like hanging out with Lord Byron, as one does, and telling scary stories based on like different like science experiments and supernatural stuff that they had heard, right? So she was super obsessed with some dude named Luigi Galvani, which is where the word galvanizing comes from, electrical experiments, right? So when Lord Byron was like, let's just write horror stories because we can't do anything else, she wrote one based on those galvanizing experiments that turned into Frankenstein. At first, it was just like a couple pages long, but everyone thought it was so freaking awesome that they were like, you should definitely make this a book. So she published it in 1818 because she is way more productive than I am. And she got it done in under a year. And she had to publish it under an anonymous, like she published it anonymously. And it wasn't until I think 1832 or that she put her name on it. It was like in the second printing or the second edition of it that she actually did put her name on it. But at first it was just anonymous, but it became really popular. And there was already like stage plays about it, like a couple years after it was published. And then obviously we know that Boris Karloff played the monster 100 years later, and it's never been out of print since its first publication. So that's pretty awesome. But what I like about the story of her writing it is that she kept rewriting the novel, right? She had several different printings of it. And every time there's like, she would change some stuff that sort of goes along with, I think, the debate or the sort of different impulses in science fiction work, right? And the difference between science fiction and fantasy. Because we have fantasy or the supernatural, right? Where there's something larger in control. There's like fate or there's ghosts. There's just some other dimension that's magical, that's in control. And then you have science fiction, which is literally like, this is how it works. It's based on science. You can theorize from the science that this is how it works. And that's what her first edition was, right? It's literally like, this is the scientific shit that Dr. Frankenstein did to create his monster. This is how it happened. And then by the final version was... the scientific elements were replaced with supernatural occurrences, right? That it was like something greater wanted Dr. Frankenstein to create that monster. So he wasn't in control of it. And that's the version that people read now, is the one that's much more supernatural than it is science fiction. And speaking of the fact that Mary Shelley had to leave off her name to publish it, that was 1818. And 200 years later, Joanne Rowling still got rejected from 9 different publishers with Harry Potter until she changed her name to J.K. Rowling and then got it published. So obviously we have not broken that glass ceiling quite yet. And she's not the only one. There's plenty of other women in science fiction that didn't reveal that they were women until they won a Nebula Award, for example. I literally can't remember who that was, but that did happen.
I actually just kind of thought of this, but I read like an article, I think it was on like NBC News or something like that, about how in the actual science technology field, there's a lot of like women that are like really in top of their field, top of their class, but still get out talked or talked over by men that, because that field sees men as being smarter, mm-hmm. Just by default. And so it's kind of, you know, leads into science fiction, even, that when women write these incredible stories, that they don't still don't get credit for it unless they either pretend to be anonymous or pretend to be a man. So, oh, I guess like another one that you can add to that, Animorphs, K.A. Applegate. She probably fits into that too, because she was a woman and she wrote like this whole series about kids turning into animals and that the whole like science genre, but she used initials as well, K.A. Applegate, instead of like her actual name. So that's another one. That's another big part of mine.
That was something that I read in fourth grade. Like, fourth grade was big on Animorphs, and I did not know at the time that she was a woman.
So there you go. But moving into the film and TV space, some of the big watershed moments in fandom history, I guess. We can start with Star Wars and Star Trek, the Outer Space Pioneers. And talk about each one and their women's influence in those genres. Star Wars, first off, I feel like it's like the one special girl kind of franchise. Like, Leia was the only woman that existed in the whole galaxy until like the second trilogy, where you introduce another one special woman. And then with the Force Awakens trilogy, Disney, I do believe that they're making more of an effort to have diversity and inclusion. There's more women in lead roles. They all look like the same woman. And then in The Force Awakens, you can also really start to see more color, quote-unquote color, in the background and the extras. There's a lot more women of color that I notice, and people of color in general, but it's almost like we, specifically women of color, are just decoration. There's no, like, large speaking... The only one right now is Rose Tico. The focus is still mainly on that one special white woman, though. So I think there's just more than just the inclusion of women. Star Wars could try a little harder on the addition of women in color and major speaking roles. Like, you know, Rose Tico is a good start, but adding more just women of color in general. Like, who's the general that wound up in the second movie? Arguing with,
Holdo?
Like, yeah. She didn't have to be a white woman.
No, she did not have to be a white one.
Yeah, so like, you know, those roles, you know, include some more diversity in there, I think.
I definitely agree with you that they need to work more on racial diversity. And that Leia was the one special woman in the galaxy, like, to the point that when the plot point drops that there is actually a twin, there's a sister, right? It's like, obviously, it can't be anyone else because there's no other women that Luke would care about. So it has to be Leia, even though they already kissed and he thought that he was in love with her. But that's moving on. That's okay. The fact that some of the most badass women in the Star Wars franchise before these latest sequels, such as Jaina Solo and Mara Jade Skywalker, who also could have been a woman of color, but oh well, can only be found in the expanded universe and were not ever brought to on screen, is another commentary on the difference, I think, or just a commentary on the difference between the written medium and the visual one. Because there's no reason why you wouldn't have been able to sell merchandise for those characters, female characters. And yet it was just in, like, offshoots of novels that a certain section of fandom gets to read where they can be prevalent and they can flourish. And then when it comes to animated series or when it comes to the movies, they just didn't really bother putting anyone in because they don't think that it can sell. And it's, and we know it does sell because Force Awakens made like $1 billion, but it's hard to convince executives that those kinds of things will sell. And it was obviously hard 30 years ago, and it's still somehow hard today, even though they have been proved wrong many times. One thing that I will say is that Force Awakens, Last Jedi, and even Rogue One have made an effort to put their diversity front and center, even though, as Jessica already pointed out, their diversity was a petite brunette white woman who is usually British, and then a bunch of, you know, men of color, and then now Rose Tico. But if you compare that to Solo, I think, which was like that banking on seeing someone who isn't Harrison Ford play Han Solo, which no one wanted, and that bombed, even though Han Solo is the one of the most iconic characters in Star Wars. Like, there's no reason a Solo movie should have bombed. So if they had tried to, you know, I don't know, focus, maybe if they focus more on Lando, or maybe if they had actually used the character of Sana Staros, who was a woman of color,
mm-hmm.
and they actually auditioned, like, 9 women of color and Emilia Clarke, and then Emilia Clarke got the role, maybe they would have been able to make up the money from the people who didn't like The Last Jedi with the people who were excited for more diversity in Star Wars. But they didn't do that.
They auditioned 9 women of color?
Yeah, I mean, I just remember that there was a list. I don't remember how long the list was, but they were like, here are the people that are the finalists for that role. And it was literally Emilia Clarke and then a bunch of black women. Wow. There was like
one of them Indian. Wasn't Zoe Kravitz one of the...
Zoe Kravitz was one of them. Tessa Thompson was one.
Did they call her the same name? Was she actually playing the character?
No, her name is something... They changed that. Her name is something else. But when it was first announced, people thought it was going to be her because that would make the most sense.
Yeah.
And again, there you go. The Solo comic book series had her sort of like co-headlining, you know? Like, I mean, obviously she's not in the title, but she was like the lead female of the comic book series. And then when it comes to a movie, they're like, nope, we can't put her in there. For reasons. Reasons unknown. And there's also the fact that Star Wars women tend to be either white or alien women. So even if they are played by a black woman or one of color, like Lupita Nyong'o played Kat. I can't remember her name now. Oh, what is...
Yeah, forget.
Maz. Anyway, so that shows you how important that role was. But... like, we don't actually get to see her. We got to see the CGI version of her. Not Star Wars, but that reminds me of how many times Zoe Saldana has played a blue or a green person. So my final note on that is that Rose got as much pushback as she did because that was the first time that the white Star Wars fandom really had to be exposed to a woman of color in a large role. Like, even though this franchise isn't going on since the 70s, 2017 was the first time that they had to see an Asian woman getting like 4th or 5th or 6th billing, whatever that was. And then they were like, how can this happen? How can she take up 20 minutes of my movie? I want my money back. In fact, I'm going to pay $25 million to make a new Star Wars The Last Jedi. So that's obviously something that's got to change.
I read somewhere, many somewheres actually, and I do need to find the links, that Star Wars was influenced somehow by the Middle East, like with its desert-like setting and some of the clothes and certain planet names and the repression of, you know, certain governments. So it's like one of the reasons why I've always been in a way that it centered white people only. It just reminded me how so many sci-fi movies can even be set in a dystopian future and still only center white people, and we rarely see any diversity. Like, I think even somebody was complaining about the recent, was it Blade Runner, and how it's set in the future, but it doesn't have, it barely has any women, and it barely has any women of color at all. So it's like,
I was just going to say that, I totally forgot, but you were right. It's also based literally on an Akira Kurosawa film. So it's based on a Japanese film, The Hidden Fortress.
Okay.
And obviously, it's Japanese people in that movie. Then you don't see them in Star Wars for a very long time. Right, okay, exactly. Continue.
Yes, so it's like problems don't matter, right? Unless they're about white people. Gasp! Oh my god. Okay, getting back to Star Wars specifically, it didn't make sense that Leia was the only woman to exist in a franchise, but it wasn't surprising at the same time. So while it's annoying that it seems to be a problem that still very much exists today, I am glad that The Force Awakens was the first Star Wars film to actually headline a woman. Like, she was the main character, and it was her journey the film was focused around, and not a man. Still, though, in The Force Awakens, Rey was still the only woman in the movie, and then Rose being the only woman of color so far in the franchise is a positive step forward, even while it still doesn't solve the problem of the women only interacting with the men in the movies. And then, even for all of Leia being a badass woman, you know, and she was, the film still largely sidelined her when she should have been the Jedi, to be honest, and not Luke, because he was undeserving.
You know, moving to the other big outer space franchise, this is more of a TV series, although they did have some movies, Star Trek. They were the other kind of major franchise that launched the sci-fi fandom, and maybe your dad wasn't a Star Wars fan because he was a Trekkie, and like, you can't have both.
Well, yes, he does always bring up that argument. But also, I think exploration was more interesting to him than just shooting in space, so.
Yeah. I think, and I also think that they did a much better job including not only racial, but also gender diversity. So maybe that's another reason why he liked it, because that's another reason why I feel like I would like it. And I don't remember, I don't remember the difference between, you know, Next Generation and Deep Space Nine and all the different versions of Star Trek. But I do remember Lieutenant Uhura was a major, you know, the first character of her kind in a series, and also the first, interracial, relationship and interracial kiss, I think, on screen. Mm-hmm. There's a lot in that original cast was just, there's a lot of diversity in there, you know, already. But she was a really major character there. And then, some other major characters that I think, when you just think of the Star Trek, you remember, Captain Catherine Janeway, played by Kate Mulgrew. And then, I specifically remember Jeri Ryan's character. She played the Borg, Seven of Nine. And the whole resistance is futile. That was a big thing. She was the blonde Angelina Jolie of the time. And so her role as Borg 709, was just kind of one of those iconic moments on TV. And then also, you know, other women of color, you have Whoopi Goldberg, who was on there, played a major role. And then not just women of color, but also men. You have LeVar Burton, who, was in the original cast along with, I can't remember her name now.
Not her name.
But LeVar Burton was also in the cast. And there's just a lot of, a lot of actually prominent people of color played in Star Trek throughout the seasons. And of course, now you have Star Trek Disco Discovery.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Samantha Martin Green. Yes.
Yeah. And
Michelle,
a lot of that, they still keep including diverse women and racial backgrounds and gender backgrounds as well in the show. So what did you guys think of all
that? Well, that reminds me of the story about how Nichelle Nichols was planning on leaving Star Trek, and Martin Luther King told her that she had to stay in order to inspire other Black women. And I think that's one of the reasons that you can't overstate the importance of not just women of color in Star Trek, generally, but the Uhura as a character specifically. Cause she was groundbreaking for her time, but like I said, she really did inspire women like Mae Jemison, the first Black woman to launch into orbit, specifically said that Uhura was her role model. So, it's just I don't know, words. But beyond just Uhura, Jessica already pointed out, there are several of them populating in the universe, and they all serve different purposes and got to have full story arcs and iconic moments. And they had several seasons, of course, films and different iterations of series in which to develop them, but they followed through on the diversity. It wasn't just tokenism for the most part, which is rare for, you know, 30 years back. The one thing that is kind of, I don't know, I guess it's like sad. It's weird, you know, that like, cause you think that you just progress as time goes on, but newer doesn't necessarily mean better. Cause like, obviously we have the recent Star Trek movies in which Uhura still got to be a main part and actually got to have the romance that she deserved with Spock, the superior romance, as opposed to the kiss with Kirk in the original series, which they had to engineer to make it like a fake out, basically. Like it really happened, but it was like a, I can't remember what happened. Like the aliens made them do it or like something. Like it wasn't part of an actual love story for them, which I think that the showrunner wanted to have an actual love story for Uhura, but the network vetoed it, basically. It was like, would not pass the censors. So they compromised with a kiss, which was the first interracial kiss on television. And now, so now she got to have a full-fledged romance and still be one of the you know, main trio of the movie. But aside from her, there was, like, not any other women happening in the Star Trek, in the new Star Trek movies. And then there was Carol Marcus, who was just basically, hello, I'm here in my underwear to look sexy for Kirk every once in a while. In that horrible Into Darkness movie. And if there was one after that, I just didn't watch, because Into Darkness was so horrible. And such a blatant ripoff of The Wrath of Khan. No, no.
The timeline had been changed, Tati. There was
I'm sorry. You're right. It's a different timeline. And therefore, things just happen, but in reverse. But yes, yeah, so thankfully we have Star Trek Discovery that is actually following through on the original promise of diversity that Star Trek gave us many moons ago. Which Jessica clearly knows more about than I do, because I watched 4 episodes.
And it's just it's somehow a surprise to people in fandom that people of color exist in space and... It's what Star Trek has always been about, but, you know.
Yeah, that's what pisses me off. I'm like, were we watching the same show back then? I don't understand.
I feel like because, like, agendas are agendas, and everyone has an agenda, so I don't mean agenda in a negative way, but agendas are more obvious now because you have all the different platforms on which you can say what you're trying to achieve. So when racists are watching with the knowledge that you are putting this on screen to help them be less racist, they get really mad.
because they don't want to learn.
I guess it's okay if those people are there.
They don't want to learn and improve themselves. But
exactly.
That's sad. But I feel like a semi-fake Star Trek fan. I have seen some of the original series, but mostly as a kid. I like barely watch them now, and maybe a few episodes of the Next Generation.
Don't know Klingon. Did you not learn Klingon, May? Did your dad teach you nothing?
I did not learn Klingon, but I do agree that the franchise did a much better job with including women and women of color far earlier than Star Wars ever did, and they did it on screen and not just in the books and the animated series. So I absolutely agree that Uhura inspired so many as the first Black woman in a sci-fi role and the first Black woman to have a biracial kiss on television, and with William Shatner's Captain Kirk, who was like the leading man of the show. Because I was at last October, I was at New York Comic Con, and they had the Star Trek Discovery panel, and it was so amazing because Sonika Martin Green was there and everybody, the cast, and then they had Macy Jameson moderate the panel, and it was just so inspiring to see her talk about how Uhura inspired her to become an astronaut and to go into space and all of that stuff. And Macy Jameson had inspired me as a kid, so I cried because I did not know she was going to be there. So it was just like really nice to see that throughout like the generations and how that continues on for the younger, you know, people watching now, watching their favorite characters be, you know, more diverse and how much that means to them. So it's very nice. And I do recall my dad saying that, like, it was how big of a deal it was and it was a big moment on television. It is sad that it didn't go beyond that, but it did pave the way. So that is amazing. And in the movies, I agree with Tati that it did kind of regress because Uhura was still there and she was involved in the romance, and that was amazing. But then she was also the only woman So, like, the rest of them were men. And then the second one annoyed me because they didn't include Carol Marcus, but it was clear that she was brought on for name recognition because she was... She first appeared in the Wrath of Khan movie, a.k.a. Star Trek II, and then she had a brief romance with Kirk, and they have a son together, but they didn't include any of that in the movie either, and then they didn't bring her back for the third one. So beyond, like, an attempt at making her just the love interest for Kirk... It didn't go anywhere. And then in the third film, Uhura still remains the only woman who isn't an alien because in the third film, they introduced Sofia Boutella's character, Jaina, but she was an alien covered in makeup, so you couldn't really tell that she was a woman of color. So much like Zoe Saldana in, you know, Avatar and Guardians of the Galaxy and how they just paint her whole body. So that is unfortunate.
Moving on from a galaxy far, far away to mythological Themyscira, Greece, and other more modern mythology, Wonder Woman, Xena, Warrior Princess, and Buffy were kind of like the intro to the female warrior princess. Not a stereotype, but like a...
Archetype?
Archetype. There you go. That's the type I'm looking for. So, like, these are Wonder Woman, Xena, Warrior Princess, Buffy are, like, the warrior princess archetypes of the genre. Wonder Woman, obviously, DC Comics, more fantasy than sci-fi, kind of the same with Xena, Warrior Princess. But she is really iconic in the sense that she's one of the leading cornerstones of DC Comics with her Superman and Batman. She's part of the Trinity. She's not seen as less than Batman or Superman, even though they try to play her between, like, both of them. Like, she's been in a relationship with Batman and a relationship with Superman, so that's kind of wonky. But she is considered on par, on level with them as far as, like, strength and abilities go. And we have the show that Linda Carter, her iconic role as Wonder Woman when it was on the TV show. Now you've got Wonder Woman movies. I think Wonder Woman was like one of the most successful movies that DC has had in forever, probably since the Dark Knight trilogy. The whole concept of Amazons and Themyscira and just, I think, seeing a woman be strong and being a warrior, I think, was something that was pretty groundbreaking, and she was one of the first ones to do that, or to be seen as that. Any other Wonder Woman thoughts from you guys?
I have many Wonder Woman thoughts, but I feel like they're all lame thoughts. No,
no lame thoughts on this podcast. Share.
Like, I don't actually remember the Wonder Woman show itself. You know, I just remember, like, the feeling of it. Right, and the thought of it in the present, but I don't actually, like, I couldn't tell you what actually happened. Kind of like Adventures of Lois and Clark, which yep. I watched, but I just know that I watched. I can't really tell you anything about it.
You missed the whole frog plot line.
Yeah, but I do like the concept of centering the woman's story, right? Even in what is thought of as a male dominated genre, but also the fact that the show had a lot more female dynamics than I think you could say that the latest movie did, you know? Because as great as the yeah. latest movie was, and that as much as, you know, we needed to see that, we needed to see that a female-led superhero film could do well at the box office and do well critically, right? That it's something that we needed, and now we're also getting Captain Marvel. Thank you for that. It literally put Diana in a man's world. Like, we didn't get as much Etta Candy. Like, Etta Candy was just, like, a sort of, like, comedic relief character in the background. We didn't really develop a dynamic between her and Diana, even though that's, like, one of her main relationships in the comics. And, obviously, the time that was spent on Themyscira was not that much because her general died and, you know, she can't go back and see her mom. So whatever. And after that, it's
because there should have been a lot more. I think they actually did whitewash one of the roles.
Because, I mean, again, they changed the name, but there was, like, a black woman that is not just Diana's mentor, but also Hippolyta's lover in some instances. Mm-hmm. She was not in the movie. Instead, we got General Lady. who I guess was the sister. Is that who she was? Antiope?
I think so.
I think I think she was.
Yeah. But we could have gotten Phoebus, and we did not. And obviously, you know, for many other reasons, like Etta Candy didn't need to be white, and we could have gotten more women just like, aren't there nurses? Aren't there nurses in the, you know, weren't there those girls that would go to, you know, there were definitely girls that went to the home front for whatever reason, you know, even if it's just as a secretary or as a nurse, et cetera, that they could have incorporated into the movie to show how women, some women were trying to be heroes, even if they weren't allowed to be in the more traditional way, not just Wonder Woman, but they didn't. So again, it sort of feels like it's backtracking, even though it was a first step that we needed, right? And what we need, again, is more women and more women of color, specifically, in the Wonder Woman sequel. And are we getting that? We don't know. Because so far we got Cheetah. And
played by Kristen Wiig.
Yeah, and that's the only other female character that we know, right?
Is the Flash Twitter actually promoted?
They just did. I swear. What? I was like, they promoted. They're like, vote for them for best chip or whatever. I'm like, what? No. Am I seeing things? This account is trash.
Did they make their own tweet? They made their own tweet.
This is incredible.
Is this the first time?
I'm in shock. I think this is the first time.
Wow.
I don't know.
They made their own little banner and everything.
I can't believe this. Anyway, it's basically like the same criticism for everything. But specifically for Wonder Woman, it's even more so than for Star Wars or for Star Trek. Because Wonder Woman, it's literally about women being wonderful. So we should see more of them and more types of them. Also, yeah, that's all. More of them, more types of them, more races, and also body positivity. Thank you.
Yes.
Okay.
I mean, for Wonder Woman, I didn't read any comics of her in it, sadly. But I did. I was introduced to her through like the Justice League animated series, and then I think, what was the one following that one? It was like Justice League Unlimited.
Yeah.
So that's where like I was introduced to her character. I never saw the old Linda Carter show, and then the Wonder Woman movie, which I liked a lot. But yeah, I agree, it suffers from lack of inclusion in general. Even though there wasn't an Arab man, which I appreciated, so that was great.
I loved him. He
was one of my favorites too. And I just think they just need to do better. Which is like the overall sci-fi problem with women.
Yeah, there definitely could have been a lot more of the Amazons involved in Diana's story instead of her just being in like a world full of dudes. It is kind of like Star Trek, Star Wars, The Force Awakens with one special girl and all her merry band of dudes.
And also Rogue One literally is like the one girl and all the men of color who follow her.
Yeah, that's actually what I was thinking of. Another warrior princess that actually has warrior princess in her title is Xena, Warrior Princess, which was a huge hit in the 90s. I loved this show. I went through a major mythology phase, like Greek and Egyptian mythology, throughout most like middle and high school. So, of course, I watched both Hercules and then when it became a spinoff. And I think it is fair to say that Xena, Warrior Princess was like, it grew to be far more popular than Hercules.
She was.
It's far more popular than Hercules, which is kind of amazing because Hercules is a pretty well-known character in Greek mythology.
I don't even remember Hercules, like, in terms of the show. Like, I remember Xena, Warrior Princess, and then when I was reading about it, I was like, that's right, it came from Hercules.
Yeah. I remember Xena on Hercules, and that's all.
Yeah, exactly. Me too. And it's kind of funny because I read, like, she was supposedly only supposed to have a 3-episode arc on Hercules and die in her third appearance. But luckily, some producers recognized that, you know, this is a good show, could be a good spinoff. And they made it to the spinoff and it became more popular than the original. And it was also pretty revolutionary, I think, because Xena was the first, like, female warrior I remember seeing on TV that was treated as, like, an equal. She was, like, an equal level with Hercules. So she's kind of like the Wonder Woman of, like, Greek mythology series on TV. And then everything about her, like her muscles, her chakrams, to her sexuality, I think, was just something that people had never seen on TV before. She had her companion. It was following, like, the Hercules prototype with Gabrielle, because I forget who Hercules is. Companion sidekick, what his name was, but it was following that.
It was like Aeolus?
Aeolus, yeah. So it was a Hercules and Aeolus, and then on Xena, they have Xena and Gabrielle. And Gabrielle also had like this really compelling evolution from the pilot all the way through the end of the series, from being this kind of like naive, like I think she's like farm girl, you know, doesn't know how to fight anything, to she's, you know, like a warrior princess in her own right by the end of the series. And then not even just like her evolution, but Xena and Gabrielle's relationship, even though they never really came out and explicitly said it, was pretty...
You felt it.
You definitely felt it. It was pretty impactful for bisexual and gay women. Like, Xena was bisexual, and I think that everyone just default was like, Gabrielle's a lesbian. And there's like so much subtext and innuendo between the two. And I feel like they kissed. I want to say it happened, like, and I think it was kind of like the Star Trek all over again, where network homophobia was like, we don't want, like, there's like a lot of fear from the network. They didn't want Xena to be like a lesbian show. And so I think that even at one point in like the title credits, they didn't even want Gabrielle and Xena in the same opening sequence, lest it be seen as a lesbian show. So they're like, no. So I feel like they did kiss, but maybe it was some kind of like compromise where this is a dream and like a fake out kind of kiss and it's not real. Lucy Lawless kind of more or less acknowledged in an interview with Conan O'Brien before the series finale that, you know, Xena is basically bisexual. I think the other reason that they never really got together was because the network also, and the show actually also really loved Ares, played by Kevin Smith, and not that Kevin Smith, but a different Kevin Smith. and they had like this really, and I liked Ares. Ares was hot, not gonna lie. He was. But I blame network homophobia more so because, you know, Xena and Gabrielle still could have had a thing or been intimate at some point in the series, and Ares still be her end game if that's what they wanted for her. But I think overall, like, it was really like one of the biggest parts I remember of like growing up in my childhood was like Xena Warrior Princess being like the shit.
Yeah, I admit. Yes. To not watching the whole show. Like, I don't remember the show from the beginning to the end, but I just remember loving Xena very much. From the music to the female-centric fantasy show that it was that involved Greek mythology, which I admit to loving and also being obsessed with. I once wrote an essay in college about how Superman was our lifetime's Hercules. So, I just thought that the show was amazing. And then Xena was, I agree, like, the Wonder Woman. She was, like, the Wonder Woman of the 90s, but to me she was better because I watched her more often, I guess. And then adding on to what Jessica was saying about how Lucy Lawless looked as Xena, she also had a nice deep voice, which is something I feel like Hollywood tries to avoid with females in leading roles. And then that made me think of what Jess McAllen was saying at that panel about how she'd be cast in like lesbian or bisexual roles because of her deeper voice. I also think it's amazing that Xena aired 134 episodes. So it did go on longer for Hercules, which was 111. Yeah. And then it was her and Gabrielle in every episode leading the show and then just going on adventures. So it was groundbreaking for the sci-fi fantasy genre. And it's not as clear to me because I haven't seen the show in so long, but I definitely agree with what Tati will go over about there needing to be more diversity because of how it meshed cultures together and they didn't cast anyone from those cultures.
Yeah, then she just said it. I'm not going to say anymore. But, you know,
I feel like that was part of my life where I wasn't, like, woke to the fact that I need diversity in my TV. So I just kind of, like, gloss over the part that there's people in the series. But, like, looking back, I can see that, definitely.
Right, and there's lots of things like that in our childhood that we never would have thought of at that time, right? You're just excited just to see, you know, these badass women on screen and even to see those hints of the other cultures that are like interesting or foreign, either foreign to you or that call to you, depending on who you are, right?
Yeah.
Either way.
Like today, I learned that there was a character on Hercules named Falafel, and falafel is totally Middle Eastern food, staple of the community. And then like this guy, he was played by a white guy and apparently he just sold it at carts. I'm like, in Greece? Like, okay.
Like, you know, that's how that goes. That sounds accurate. But about the kiss. So the kiss was like, they had to have a true love kiss to like complete the quest, I think. So, but Xena, I think, was in some other dude's body. So, Gabrielle and this dude kiss. But of the spirit plane, you see that Xena and then Gabrielle. So you get to see it, and it is Xena that she's kissing, but it is physically some dude.
So they try to have it, like, both ways at the same time.
Yes. Yes. Which kind of reminds me of, I don't know, because I said spirit plane, that's why it reminds me. It just reminds me of Kurosami in Legends of Korra, because at the end of the series, Korra and Asami finally get together, but it's just they hold hands and go to the spirit plane together. And you have to read the comics. Or the
and that was so talked about after the finale, too.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And some people were like, it's friendship. It's like, not friendship. But anyway. The only other thing that I was going to say about Xena Warrior Princess was just the fact that it is so much more remembered. Like, I don't even remember who played Hercules at this point. Like, I don't know. I couldn't tell you who played Hercules. Are you going to, did you just tell me? Okay, no. I was like, don't tell me. That's the point. It doesn't matter who played him, because Xena Warrior Princess is such an iconic, like, part of our history now. You know, like, when you hear Lucy Lawless, you know exactly who that was. When she was on Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., everyone's like, Xena! Xena's on Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D.!
Yeah, she was on Parks and Rec. I was like, oh my god, Xena!
Yes! Yes! Oh god!
The Gladiator show on, what was it, Stars? I think.
Oh, Spartacus, yeah.
Spartacus, yeah. Xena was on there.
You know who wrote for Spartacus? The Helpings. Anyway. Oh. Anyway. That's all.
Tati has to let us know about her Helbing history.
About her husband history.
About my husband. Yes. Anyway, not only did it last longer than Wonder Woman, the series, but because Gabrielle and Xena were centered so strongly, you know, it's something that really fulfills, I don't know, just basically, you know, like, it's the female equivalent of male power fantasies, right? It's girl power fantasies.
Mm-hmm. Yay. Moving into more modern kind of version of this warrior princess genre, you've got Buffy the Vampire Slayer. And she's kind of like a precursor to 21st century women in sci-fi. I remember watching Buffy. That was another, like, big show for me growing up. I wasn't like deep into, like, the fandom, but, just again, it was one of those a woman is leading a show and kicking ass, and she is like the shit. Like, she isn't like the sidekick to another dude that's also the shit, but she is the shit, and she has people and her team, and she's like the one true savior kind of thing. That's kind of like revolutionary. And I feel like it's with the whole dynamic between, like, her, Angel, and Spike, that kind of relationship drama, I feel like was like the prototype really for True Blood.
Love triangles.
Yeah. You know, like, with Sookie, Bill.
Eric, yeah. True Blood,
is it the same damn thing? Did either of you ever have, like, Buffy the Vampire feelings?
I remember watching it, like, I think I started in the summer between its third and fourth seasons, like, right when she was about to actually go to college and her... So I was watching, like, all the reruns of the third season, and then into the fourth season they had, like, introduced, I feel like Joss Whedon, I wouldn't call it him inventing the retcon, but, like, kind of putting in a character that didn't exist and suddenly existing and explaining it, that's, you know, sudden
the
appearance
Dawn.
Of someone. Dawn. So, like, this woman just shows up out of nowhere, and everybody's like, who the fuck is this? Buffy doesn't have a sister. And then, you know, that whole, kind of changed the whole trajectory of the show in a lot of ways, because she was a character, but she was also a plot point. So it was just like this big deal. But, like, as a character, I think Buffy headlining, you know, her own show kind of opened up the gates for other women to also kind of headline their own show in sci-fi. And it was just like she got to be the ass kicker, and she also got to have very bad romances.
A lot of bad shit on that show, and they didn't really shy away from that. They kind of leaned into it.
Right.
And then you have Willow, who Wasn't Willow in love with Buffy at one point?
She was
not with Buffy, not with but Buffy. She did have a girlfriend, Tara. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So there was a lot of people I've heard at panels or just in the fandom talk about how that meant a lot to them that Willow was kind of like one of the first openly gay characters on a show, on a sci-fi show that they watched, and that was like a big deal because she did start off with what's his face? Oh my god.
She was in love with Xander at first.
She was,
and then she dated Oz.
She dated Oz. Yes.
Yep.
And then she realized she liked ladies and she got with Tara. I think they killed Tara, though, which is shitty.
They did, but... and that's how Willow became evil, and that was the plot line a lot of people didn't like, because it kind of like...
she went dark.
She went dark. Dark Willow
did. He also invented bury your gays. No, I'm just kidding. He didn't invent that either, but...
yeah. But it did... I mean, I feel like the show also... It was revolutionary, but then it also had, like, things that... punished characters for wanting to be happy, but it's also credited for inventing the season-long big bads for sci-fi shows that we see now.
So thanks for the thing.
Yeah. Thanks but no thanks. But yeah, I mean, as a like a female, it was always just revolving around her and what she could do in her journey. And they also had like her family life, and so that was always good to see. Like the relationship she had with her mom was good, and she just kind of like opened the doors into the 21st century sci-fi women. But also their diversity kind of sucked too.
Yeah. And that's another one of the stories where it's like, at the time it was really revolutionary and groundbreaking, and we do owe a lot, you know, to Buffy and to Joss Whedon for creating Buffy. But when you go back and look at certain things, you think like, oh, that's actually kind of icky. Like, oh, I kind of feel icky about that, especially in light of what we, you know, what we've seen from Joss Whedon since and what we know about Joss Whedon now. It's still like so many of our icons or role models as women are filtered through the light of how men, you know, shape mm-hmm. them or how men want them to be seen. And one thing I was going to say, like, you know, Buffy spinned off Angel and took Cordelia with him, right? So as many people know, but maybe not everyone knows, Charisma Carpenter got pregnant while she was filming Angel, and Joss Whedon did not like that, so he killed off Cordelia. And then he brought her back, like, oh, I'm sorry about that, we'll bring you back, just to kill her again. So!
Oh, no wonder she's still so salty.
Yes, so she is still salty. And as far as I know, I feel like I don't actually, you know, not to spread rumors, but as far as I know, Sarah Michelle Gellar does not like Joss Whedon. And I don't know why, but considering his statement about all these women that he had power over and just throwing themselves at him and how could he help himself, I, you know.
You said I don't know what happened. You don't think she doesn't like
that
him?
Sarah Michelle Gellar does not like Joss Whedon, yeah. But despite that, we can't disregard how important Buffy was and still is, you know, in our history as a character, and that someone that just like Xena, like Lucy Lawless will always be Xena, Sarah Michelle Gellar will always be Buffy.
Yeah. Yeah.
Did you want to discuss Firefly briefly?
Yeah, I could say.
Didn't he also create the Dollhouse?
Yeah.
He did create Dollhouse, which is another one. And Dollhouse... You know, Eliza Dushku, one of his muses, because she was Faith on Buffy. And then he created Dollhouse around her, which, again, is a show all about a deconstruction of how men view women, right? Or use women, abuse women by a man who may do that. So that's interesting. Layer. Many layers. But anyway, Firefly has also a bunch of really memorable women. But, like... It's interesting because you have Miranda Bachrann played Inara, okay? And Inara is a courtesan, basically. Is it prostitution is not just legal but respected in this future sci-fi cowboy land. And so it's one of the like greatest professions that you can have. And like people like, you know, all the rich, all the wealthy people like vie to have the best courtesan. Of course. Inara is one of them. And yet, despite this, and her main romance with Mal, who was, dude, y'all know this dude, Castle, I can't remember his name.
Nathan Fillion, yes.
So that's like the main romance of the show. But Nathan Fillion's character, Mal, hates the fact that Inara is a prostitute and is always mocking her for it and is always treating it like it's something to be disrespected, even though the backstory of the narrative tells you that it is something respected. But our hero does not respect her. So it's very weird that they would do this. Anyway, speaking of women of color specifically, Gina Torres, lovely Gina Torres, plays Zoe, who is the, she's like the first-hand woman. She's like the, sorry, I don't remember. Mal is the captain. Zoe's the next in charge. Zoe Washburn. And she's married to Alan Tudyk, whose name is Wash.
Yeah. So I don't remember his first name either.
Yeah. She's in command. She gets to command, and at some point she is even the captain herself, right? But she's also not like a just a hard ass, right? She does get to be vulnerable. Like, we get to see a lot of, especially in her relationship with Wash. We get to see like a nice fleshed out marriage, because it's not like we see the romance from when they met, etc. Just they're already married. But it is very sweet. So it's like you have an interracial ship on the show. And even though I would say that I think she's the only woman of color really on the show, mm-hmm. as far as I know.
Yeah.
Everyone else is by women. And weirdly, in this world, the two superpowers were like US and China, right? So everyone speaks English or Chinese, and they have a bunch of Chinese swear words. So like whenever they want to pass the censors, they speak in Chinese. But were there any Chinese characters on that show? No, there were not. No, there were not. So I don't know how that happened.
Just superpower, but no Chinese people on the show. That's weird.
Yeah, it doesn't make sense.
It's like in a future where other planets have been like terraformed, and I mean there was only like 14 episodes and a movie, but
right. But there's also plenty of comic book material and books, etc. Yeah. Like it's another one.
It has a very like loyal fan base.
Yeah. That has outlived its actual series. And I loved Firefly. Like, I was like, oh my god, it's so amazing!
Yeah, but I saw it when they put it on like, Netflix, on it, and it was, you know, I was like, I have to watch the movie immediately.
But yeah, but I wish that we had gotten more diversity. That is, the moral of the story is that nothing has enough diversity. Except for, like, Luke Cage. That's not even diversity. That's just representation. So, there you go. It's like two different things. But representation is good. Like, when you have a story based on a culture, you should have the people of that culture. Like, Luke Cage has black people in Harlem, as one would imagine that you would have. And how do they, on the other hand...
Like, how do they even the Chinese, if the Chinese is accurate without having Chinese people? That's gotta suck. If you're, like, a Chinese writer for Firefly, but there's no Chinese people on the actual show, like...
Yeah, no, you'd be like... And I highly doubt they had Chinese writers either. I'm sure they were like, Google Chinese.
Yeah, that's probably true. I doubt they had any Chinese writers.
Fake Chinese, then.
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
Like, someone that's from China that has actually watched Firefly, please tell us how hard you laughed at people trying to speak Chinese on this show. But moving along into the 21st century sci-fi woman, Evolution of Women in Doctor Who. I did not go here, so I'm going to pass this off to May and Sian to, like, tell us about the evolution of women in this franchise in particular.
Okay. It's going to follow my same thesis as everything else, which is that progress is very cyclical, and things that were really progressive 40 years ago are somehow, we're still fighting to have them again now, which is very strange, but... Doctor Who has obviously always been a show about a dude, an alien man who is the Doctor and is, of course, an all-powerful being. And he's literally surrounded by women who just want to put their lives on pause to follow him around space and time. So it's like, it's not particularly progressive. But because every Doctor has a female companion, there's always been a female co-lead in the series. And most of the time... In the original series, it was not romantic, right? Like, the idea wasn't that it was like, oh, romantic tension between Doctor Who and Ben. It was literally just like, two people are going to wander the world. And sometimes it was more than two people, because the first doctor literally had like a couple, like teachers. It was a man and woman, and then his granddaughter. So there was two women. But the point is that like these women usually had like their home life that you got to see, and like things that they would put on pause, or like they would put their traveling on pause to go live their lives, and you get to have character arcs for them, and they were often just as memorable as the doctor himself. But once it was revived, right? And even, you know, even in the time that it was off, like I think it was off the air for, I don't even know how long, like 15 years or so, they would have audio dramas and novels that would come out. And the women, like the companions in that time, would also play a really large and important role. And that didn't change in the RTD and Moffat era with this new reboot, right? It started with Christopher Eccleston as the Ninth Doctor. The women are just as iconic. Like everyone remembers Rose and Amy and Martha, and everyone fights over their favorite companion. But suddenly, romance was just like at the forefront too, right? Like everyone, when I first even heard about Doctor Who, it was because of people shipping Rose and the 10th Doctor. And I just did not, I was like, what is Rose and the Doctor? I definitely thought, you know what? I actually thought it was like a resurgence of love for Titanic at one point. Because you guys know our fave Malcolm Merlyn, right? John Barrowman plays a character named Jack in The Doctor. So one time I saw a Rose and Jack video and I was like, oh, is this Titanic? And then I watched it. No, it was The Doctor. And then I saw everyone else was shipping Rose and The Doctor. So I was like, oh, okay. I guess I should check this out. But anyway, that's a tangent. Rose's whole life revolves around The Doctor. And when it's not The Doctor, it's her poor boyfriend, Mickey, who she abandoned to be with The Doctor. And so then even her happy ending, or her closure at the end of her arc, is to get a human version of The Doctor for herself. So it's like, And then you had Martha, who was a black woman played by Freema Agyeman, and therefore got a whole shit ton of hate, not just because she was black, but also because she was, surprise, in love with the doctor, who was still getting over Rose. And people were like, how dare she be in love with the doctor when she is not worthy, for reasons I don't know, even though she is literally a doctor. She is literally a doctor. So like the whole thing was like, LOL, he's called the doctor, but she's actually the doctor. So when you need an actual doctor, she is there. Anyway, she's the best. Martha's awesome. But people hated her and refused to see her arc, which, again, her arc was literally letting go of her one-sided love for the doctor and realizing that she is good enough to live her life on Earth and save people on Earth and not float around space and time with some white alien dude who doesn't love her. So, I don't know. I don't know how you know, that arc's a little bit, but at least she learned to love herself at the end. And then you had Amy, who was actually the first woman, the first Doctor series that I watched. I started with the 11th Doctor, and so I watched Amy before I actually went back and watched the others. And she's, like, spunky. She's super fun. Obviously, Karen Gillan is amazing. But, again, it's literally all, will she get with the Doctor, or will she stay with Arthur Darvill, Rory? And then she has a secret pregnancy baby. How will she find her baby? You know, like literally everything about her story goes back to the dudes that she's with, or the fact that motherhood is something that she can do. Like it's trying to be progressive, but it's really regressive. So I don't know. Clara came after that. No one knew anything about Clara. It was just literally her thing was that she's a mystery wrapped in an enigma that the doctor has to solve. But she does get Danny Pink as a love interest.
And she's only an enigma for like a few episodes before she actually became a regular.
Yes, she was still like, once she got her own story, right?
Yeah.
Then she got Danny Pink was her story.
Yes.
That was her romance. And he was great, but they hated him because he was black. That's also a recurring theme as well. And then after he died, it was like, she went back to just being like the person that travels with the doctor. Like, I don't know. You don't really get her personal life, which is something that you used to get 40 years ago. So I don't know, it's really weird. I totally forgot about Donna, by the way. At the end of Donna's arc, her memory just gets erased. But she gets to marry some dude. So she's happy. She gets to marry some dude.
You know,
anyway.
Okay, so, sorry, I was going to add on to that, but continue.
Oh, add on.
Oh, are you done?
No, I mean, I was going to say Bill is the last one, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, you did get, like, Bill, who is not only Black, but a lesbian. So that was, like, the first time that we actually got a companion whose companion add-on, whose plus one, was also a woman. But she only lasted one season. So it's not like and they gave her, like, a weird, like, her romantic arc was, like, the girl that she loved became a puddle. But then they get to travel the world together at the end. So that's
Bill's run is the one I need to finish watching.
Yeah. But I mean, like, it's good because we've gotten to see, like, an increase in diversity mm-hmm. on the show, and also more, I guess you'd say, more screen time for the women. But the showrunner that we've had for the last several years is quite misogynistic. And it's also, for example, the showrunner of Sherlock. So definitely white dudes with god complexes is his thing. And now, finally, coming up this year, we're going to have a female doctor for the first time in, what is it, 60 years? 50 years? 50-something years? The first female doctor, even though the conceit from the beginning has always been that time masters don't have genders, so he could have become a woman at any time. And with a 50-50 chance, he finally did it on the 13th time. So.
13 is the lucky charm.
Exactly. 13 is the lucky number. But we're going to have a new showrunner in Chris Chibnall, and a new setup with the companions, right? I think it's like she has a male companion. I think there's also another female companion, but it's like she has several companions. So it's going to be different in many ways. And I look forward to seeing what Chris will do with it.
That is interesting. I look forward to seeing how they do that too, because I did start watching. I haven't seen any of the older Doctor Who episodes. I came in with the new Who in 2005, which I didn't watch until like 2014 and 2013. but I did find it interesting that all the women did have feelings for the Doctor, except now that you mention it, Donna, who did not have feelings. It was they were just like friends. There was no unrequited love. Nothing. And
thank God.
Yes. But I feel like with the exception of Clara and the 12th Doctor and Bill and the 12th Doctor, each for different reasons. So like the first being that Clara probably didn't find the 12th Doctor's incarnation to be visually appealing, even though the Doctor is himself old as fuck, no matter what he looks like on the outside. And then Bill is, of course, a lesbian, so she's not going to fall in love with him anyway. So I just think that's interesting that the women that did love him at any given point, they loved the versions of him that were the younger versions. Like, no one loved Peter Capaldi's version like that.
Poor Peter.
Yeah.
Although some people still did ship it and insisted that Clara was choosing the Doctor over Danny because she would, you know, rather bone the Doctor.
What? Oh, okay, this has gone too far. Anyway. This is why I leave fandom sometimes. Anyway, and no matter how much I personally love Amy, she was one of my favorites. I feel like Clara and Martha are the ones who had, well, actually Martha had a fuller life on the outside because we like knew her family, her sister, her mother, her father. We saw that part and like she had a good job and she helped people. So that was her ambition. And they did end up all leaving him to go back to their lives, but also a lot of times they were forced to go. So, except Martha was the only one who voluntarily left with the decision wasn't made due to like an adventure gone wrong or she got stuck somewhere in, you know, time displacement or something. And I can't speak for Bill because I haven't seen those episodes, but I hope that she didn't leave because of like she was forced to leave. Like I hope that it was on her own terms too. And I feel like River, I mean, for me, River was always kind of like the female version of the Doctor, only because like she came and went as she pleased. She had her own adventures. I'm sure she's like, she had several men on the side besides the Doctor, but she always like came back to him in some shape or form. And I do agree that Moffat was, or is that how you say his name?
I don't remember if it's Moffat or Moffat, okay. But either way.
He was, like, kind of obsessed with certain characteristics for his female characters. And so the only way to see change or the only way to now see the change going forward, now that we have a new female doctor and a new showrunner, to see how, like, that shift will happen. But it is interesting.
Speaking of River, mm-hmm. she literally was the female version of the doctor because she had her reincarnations.
Yes.
Which she gave up to give the doctor more reincarnations.
Yes. Stuff.
This is very enlightening, but I'm going to, like, move over to something that I can actually talk about.
Yeah, you got a whole, like, Doctor Who history.
Just being quiet. Yes, I am done. I want to talk now. Just kidding. But while we're here, I do want to slip in Humans, the TV series from the BBC, because that's another, it's like a hugely sci-fi related series about these robots called Synths that have been created to kind of, like, take over the, you know, nanny jobs and factory jobs and all this, because it's kind of like humans and synthetic robots living together. And there are a group of Synths that were created by this, you know, the originator of it, creating, like, synthetic human beings. But he gave these particular Synths a conscience. And so they get separated for some reason. And this kind of, like, first season is all about them, you know, coming back online and like, fighting each other and coming together. And you've got Gemma Chan, who is the lead. She, I think her real name is Anita. No, her real name is Mia. But she gets bought by the Hawkins family to be their new maid. And then the kind of, the thing is that she's, like, the lead of the series, but it's kind of interesting how they played her as Anita with the family versus her sister, Niska, who is played by Emily Barrington, and she's, like, white, blonde, kind of, like, German aesthetic-looking girl. And Niska actually had, like, a rough beginning because she got assigned to work in, like, a brothel or something when they were separated, so she's had, like, a more violent history with humans and turns out to resent them and becomes this kind of, like, a Nikita style assassin, revengeful kind of person. And so even though, while as Mia is working with this family, and then there's this kind of, like, weird undertones of both the dad and the son wanting to, like, have sex with her, and she can't really do anything about it because she's supposed to pretend to be like, not have a conscience. And so it's really weird how the show treated her versus Niska's role. I haven't really caught up with the third season yet, but there's a lot of, like, weird undertones where I think Mia was just kind of made to be responsive. Like, she's a little bit more, she, like, in the second season, she got a lot tougher and more independent, not as willing to take whatever, like, the humans wanted her to do. But just, she's more subservient, I think, in season one, or written to be more subservient, which is kind of interesting with her being the woman of color, whereas you have Niska, right, with more of, like, the stereotypical I am badass female woman TM kind of thing. So that was interesting. Do either of you watch Humans?
I have not, but I feel like I should.
It's a very interesting show. So, you know, like I said, there are some, like, creepy moments with just, like, the dynamics. And also, like, Mia was created to be a babysitter for the original scientist, his son. He had a son named Leo. So she was built to be Leo's babysitter, but then also she and Leo fell in love. So,
aww.
A lot of stuff going on there. And then I think the other one that I don't know if you want to, it's not really sci-fi, but it's more like fantasy with the Magicians. I feel like we should mention them as well, with three women on the Magicians, mm-hmm. Julia, Alice, and Margot. And I think
technically there's four. Who's the Katie fourth? Exists.
Well, yeah, sorry. I think, oh, she's the one that leaves the least impression on me. But I think particularly for that show, Julia and her trajectory from where she started into where she is now, I think has really progressed. And I like that with the magicians, like a lot of, I think over half the characters are somewhere on the sliding LGBT scale. Margot is bisexual. Julia arguably is bisexual because there's a little bit of subtext in some of like her relationships on the show. So it's just another modern show of how women in sci-fi fantasy are coming to the forefront and getting like full-fledged personalities and character arcs, even if you hate them, like Alice.
Yep. Even if I hate Alice, she does get her own story arc.
Yeah.
Arguably interesting.
Arguably. But it's
but yeah, and even though I, you know, we can say that, like, visibly speaking, the women are all white. But
Margot is less visibly white.
Yeah, she's less visibly white. But there's not an actual reference to the fact that Summer Bischel is South Asian, and certainly not. That Selah Mabe is Native American. Yeah, yes. Native American. I feel like Jade Taylor might be something. Oh, also Native American. But you wouldn't know it. So yeah. But at least it sort of exists. but more importantly, it is that the women all get to sort of be individual entities, whether or not you ship them with anyone. And I guess half of them don't really have ships, right? Half of them, because Katie and Julia don't have a ship. No, Katie has a ship. Katie has Penny, the best ship. And Alice has Quentin, the worst ship.
The worst.
And then Margot.
You told me Alice and Quentin aren't a thing anymore.
Well, they're still her ship. She doesn't have another ship. It's so Matt Quentin.
Sad, yeah. A brief thing of Penny when she was mad at Quentin.
Right, but that doesn't count. Good. Yeah, that doesn't really count. That counts as much as, like, Quentin and Margot counts. But, yeah, and Margot and Julia are also free agents. And
I also think, like, one thing about Margot, and I love Margot, and I felt like for a long time in this past season that I felt like she was getting the shaft a little bit with her being stuck in the magical world, having to run a kingdom, and just getting, like, beaten over the head with, like, people trying to invade, and then there's that weird thing where she's, like, an arranged marriage, and it was just, then it turned to an arranged child marriage, and it was just, like, you know, kind of, it felt like really beating her down. But I think at the end of the season, when she turned up, first when she meets the Pirate King, who is actually a woman, but she's, like, I'm king, so I get to be called whatever the fuck I want to be called, and I want to be called the Pirate King.
Yes!
At the end of the season, her being able, like, Margot herself becoming king of Fillory, it was just kind of, like, a really great moment for her as the only obvious woman of color, even though they don't really say it. I think it's, you know, it's close to as default as I think any of the characters are, other than Penny, who is just obviously a brown man.
Yep.
I hope for, I actually do really do hope for her, because she seems to be in a really good position for next season, and so I hope they continue to build on her in the way that they've built on Julia since season one.
Yeah, I think that there was definitely a nice through line that wasn't as obvious of her having to fix things behind the scenes, pretty much, you know? Like, yeah. Elliot was, like, the king for, like, front and center, but he was the one also fucking shit up while Margot was fixing it, so.
Yes.
So, yeah, hopefully, like you said, she'll get the Julia treatment next season, and it will be beautiful. Because Julia has the best character arc, and is the greatest.
Yes, that I agree all. With this. It's the only thing I have to say about the Magicians, because I only just started season two.
That you like Julia? Is that the only thing?
Well, yeah, I've always liked Julia.
Okay. Now that we're, in the 21st century, moving into, and we've talked about, like, sci-fi fantasy, but into the rebirth of the female science fi action lead, you know, like we've mentioned before, Star Wars, the newest series of the Force Awakens trilogy, and this recent crop of white brunettes, it's like the only area that we've seen women rise up in the science fiction genre. And that, as did happen with Star Wars, with both Daisy Ridley and Rose Tico, you also have man babies that can't fathom why this is happening to them. So you get, like, in this section, you have, like, the, when you say rebirth, there's, like, a lot of remakes that were taking something that was kind of a cult classic, but usually male-dominated, and is now being reborn with more female action lead focus. So one example we had was Mad Max Fury Road, which I don't really go here either for the original or for the remake, so I can't talk about that. But I will talk about Ghostbusters a little bit later. So starting with Mad Max, what thoughts do you guys have?
So what I love about Mad Max is how it made Furiosa the actual lead of the movie, like, de facto, even though it's called Mad Max. So you go in expecting Mad Max, right? And that was, like, I think the character was originally Mel Gibson, mm-hmm. and this time it was Tom Hardy. And Tom Hardy is best when he doesn't get to say a lot. I love him, but that's just how it is. So that worked out on all sides. But Charlize Theron really likes... She didn't just steal the movie. Like, they really did hand her the movie on a silver platter. But it worked, at the very least, critically speaking. Financially, I don't know, like, you could argue about how well it did. It made back its money, but it wasn't like some crazy, like, Star Wars success. However, the way they did that was by still giving it the Mad Max name and just enough of him. Like, his story was to help her and her, you know, the wives of evil dude, get to safety, right? So he is still, like, the hero of the story, but she's really the one doing all the heroic things. And even her you know, companions, like the wives, all get to have, like, their moments to be heroic as well. So yeah, I love this. Like, and I didn't watch the originals, and it's not something that I would ever be interested in. The only reason that I went to go see it is because my friend really wanted to, and was like, I promise you it's going to be good. So we did, and it was beautiful.
Yeah, it was. I saw it twice, and it was just, like, really good. And with the budget-wise, at least, I mean, it was nominated for a bunch of Oscars, so they got that, I guess, instead. But I feel like this movie did trick people, like you said, and Max was the character I gave the least fucks about. Like, I did not care for him for the most part of the movie. And then centering the movie on Furiosa and her rescue of the woman from the psycho who deprived his own people of water and was just a sexist, misogynist asshole. And then taking them to other women and her own home to be protected made it one of the more feminist sci-fi movies of the 21st century. Having said that, the film's feminism wasn't exactly intersectional because the one non-white woman of the group...
So there was Zoe Kravitz. How right, dare you?
Zoe Kravitz was the only one of the main group who was not a white woman.
Yeah.
So again, it needs to do better, but...
There was, like, five, right? Yeah. So there was no reason why there couldn't have been more.
I mean, I think the women that she took them to were... Some of them were Native women, were they not?
Yes.
Yeah.
But they don't get...
They don't get as much. Section. Yeah.
Ghostbusters is another remake that men got very, very, very upset about because they remade the original, which was for guys, into a new original, which was for women. Tati, I'll let you say your piece first because mine, like, comes off of yours. So, like,
okay. I was going to say one thing that apparently does not work for reboots or remakes is to gender bend the franchise without including the male power fantasies that fanboys are so obsessed with. So, like, even though Ghostbusters was just fine as a film, like, I've seen the original and I watched this one and I was like, that was fine. It was like a literal campaign beforehand to crush the film. And then, you know, like, that was, like, I think the beginning of the whole, like, Rotten Tomatoes, like, bringing down the audience score, you know, IMDb bringing down the star rating, etc., and, like, basically spreading the word not to see the movie. so that it would tank. And it did work. And then Leslie Jones in particular faced abhorrent racial abuse for not just being a woman in the franchise, but a black woman, even though she was replacing a black man, just like the white woman replacing white men. So, but apparently it was so much worse that she was there than that the others. So, you know, story stays the same. One thing that I did find interesting was that, and even though this isn't sci-fi, Ocean's 8 came and went, or it hasn't gone anywhere yet, it's still around, but it came just fine. Like, there wasn't some kind of huge backlash against it. Like, I'm sure, like, there was definitely people that were like, well, that's not necessary, right? Or that's a SJW agenda. But even though there was more diversity in Ocean's 8 than in Ghostbusters, it did just fine critically, like, not amazing, but it's like fine, and it's doing well financially speaking. I guess, like, on the one hand, like, no one is like clinging to the Ocean's 11 franchise, which in and of itself was already a remake, right? When George Clooney came, it was already a remake of a different Ocean's 11. But on the flip side, there's also something, it feels like there's something specific to the sci-fi fantasy fandom that makes it much harder to break the, you know, metaphorical glass ceiling with it. Like, it's just like that stereotype or of, you know, that extreme of like the dude dwelling in his mother's basement, hating on everyone, seems to be more and more of a reality. So.
And like what I was going to say that blows off of your comments, the interesting comparison about Ocean's 8, I would say is because Ocean's franchise was like relatively newer from, you know, the George Clooney remake of the movie, that it didn't really have like the kind of, didn't really seem to have the kind of cult following or nostalgia that Ghostbusters had from the original. And I guess like also the Ocean's remake isn't a remake, but it's like a continuation of the original canon. So of sorts. So that may have also lessened the hate because they weren't like redoing Ocean's 11. They were just continuing on to that story. I won't rule out Ghostbusters being sci-fi nerd specific, though, because I think that probably does have a lot to do with it, this particular genre in general. But the thing that was most interesting to me about the whole thing is that although fanboys tried to widely pan the movie and boycott the movie in general, the entire movie, Leslie Jones was like the main cast member to get the brunt of hate, like you said. And it's not like no one was sending that kind of hate to, you know, Melissa McCarthy and Kristen Wiig and that other crazy girl.
Whose name that is? Other crazy girl? Is it Kate McKinnon?
Yeah. I really love her in Saturday Night Live, but yeah. But like no one was sending them the kind of hate that Leslie Jones is getting. And it was not just hate even about her characters, hate about her physical appearance. And I would say that with Leslie Jones, she's had a bit of a rough, because even when she started on Saturday Night Live and she was doing like the news portion, she got like a really polarizing reaction. So it's a lot about like her physical appearance mainly, and the fact, you know, different body type, different, you know, physical type and everything like that. And so there's a lot of hate about her, just her appearance, even her just like having the space to be a person in a movie at all. And I, like, the other thing is I just remember, like, a lot of her social media co-stars that also have Instagram and Twitter accounts being pretty fucking silent during that time. That also, like, not only the hate that she got, but the silence of the people that were supposed to be her co-stars and backing her up was pretty damn loud to me. It was great to see the kind of fandom and media pushback against all the hate that Leslie Jones was getting. I remember there being like a "We love you, Leslie" hashtag kind of thing that was kind of getting going. And I think like right after that, like people started really promoting her a lot. Like she got, I think it was around the time of the Winter Olympics, so she got really a lot of attention, like live tweeting the Olympics and stuff like that. And so there was, and that a result of people pushing back against hate that she got. But I think it also would have been better if some of that pushback had came from the white women that she was in the movie with. Period.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
Yeah. I agree with that. I think you both made good points and comparisons between the two films. And I agree that part of the hate does stem from geekdom or sci-fi geekdom, because white nerdy men have largely claimed that for themselves. Like, it's always belonged to them. And women can't occupy that space, apparently. So they, like, flip out.
even though Ghostbusters wasn't even that good, whatever, like, the original was, like, okay. But, and of course, like, this is especially true of black women, and it's why Leslie Jones received the most hate, and, I recall the hate, and I do remember her co-stars being more silent about that, but now I'm like, I remember it, but now that you brought it, like, back, I'm just like, oh, yeah, they were really quiet. I don't follow any of them on anything, I don't think, but it's... When it comes to these type of things, it's always we can scream to the rooftops, but you need allies. And if you're getting hate and white women who are co-starring with you aren't helping you out, then that's just
right. And that's like what we were talking about last week too. You know, like mm-hmm. it's not like you need to have a white ally who's like, you know, making way for you, but it is an easier and effective way of quieting right. people who are going to respond to those that they view as equals, you know?
Exactly.
So even though it's like a false, like you're not actually changing anyone's minds by having your white women co-stars speak up for you, but you are at least saving yourself. You know?
Well, yeah, I mean, like, no one's going to sit there and abuse. Be like, oh, I expect you to bring out your pitchfork every time someone makes a comment. But when it's, like, that mm-hmm. bad, especially for, mm-hmm. you know.
A show of solidarity would have been right. very much appreciated, I think.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Especially in spaces where, like, people are louder. Movies have, you know, more people watching, perhaps, because they're people go see them. It's only 2 hours of your life. You know, it's not, like, a major investment.
And people, and like, these are like people that, you know, cry out feminism and let us do things, but then you don't support another woman. It goes back to the whole right. like white feminism kind of no intersectionality in our feminism kind of thing. So, exactly. But Westworld was one that I wanted to slip in as well. And there, cause this another, it's kind of like humans and this another like synth robotic, and real life people living in the same, interacting, and you know how humans mistreat synth robots because we're just like the worst.
We can't help it.
We can't help it. We're the worst. But it's very interesting to see, especially in Westworld, their two lead female characters, where you have Dolores, white woman, played by Rachel Wood. Who plays Dolores, and Dolores starts out as this kind of like meek, mild-mannered country girl host that is just always just taken advantage of by the local human douchebags and even like the other synth robots hosts in Westworld, and she becomes like awakened, gains her consciousness, and now. So, like, the whole first season was her, like, awakening. It was very much of, like, a feminist girl power kind of deal. And then you also had Maeve, who was the madam in the town, like, saloon. And so she's, like, a courtesan. So they, two basically, women from two basically different parts of the park. And mm-hmm. Maeve has her own kind of awakening and revolution. And, hers is like she, like Dolores has Teddy and she has William, like the whole first season, you know, she's getting her white woman on with all of her male saviors doing stuff for her and helping her through this journey. And Maeve is pretty much on her own and like doing stuff on her own. And Maeve is played by Fanny Newton, so yes. Black woman, and she's basically coming into this and she's super smart. But she like comes awake and she figures out how to get the scientists behind the scenes to kind of help her get out. And she has her evolutionist leading her towards escape. And Dolores' evolution is leading her towards, like, enlightenment or whatever. And so then the second season, it's kind of interesting because it really seemed the first season, like, Dolores is set up to be, like, you know, like, the white woman on the pedestal. And Maeve is, like, she's strong and in her own right, but she's not Dolores kind of thing. But then in the second season, it seems kind of like it's like flipped a little bit. Dolores has gone super crazy. She's like the death bringer and kind of like falling apart and devolving into this, like, evil, metaphysical, like, she's becoming the thing that she always hated, you know, with, like, the humans kind of deal. And she's being shown as being a little bit crazy and in the wrong with some of the things that she does to get what she wants. Whereas Maeve has reached this total enlightenment to the point where that she can reach out and liberate other hosts in the park or even speak to them telepathically. And so she's becoming a little bit more godlike, and she's seen being written as being on the right side of the things in the show. So it was really actually kind of interesting to me to see this kind of reversal of white feminism in the second season. So that's kind of...
Do you think it was like on purpose?
I don't know. Like, I wonder if it was on purpose because, you know, part of me feels like it was. Just because in the second season, they've also brought in more about different cultures with the samurai world where they had like the Japanese episode. And then also the recent episode that was, I can't remember how to pronounce the episode title, but it was about the Ghost Nation and it was narrated the leader of the Ghost Nation, and it was like 90% of the episode or 90% of the scenes were in Lakota, so it was subtitled for most of the episode. Even like,
that's cool.
Yeah, it's really like, it's really well done. But like that kind of focus that they give more to the diverse parts of the park and the park's history, and that were previously not really acknowledged in the first season, kind of makes me feel like it was on purpose that the switch between Dolores and Maeve, but it is kind of interesting to see that. So I wanted to include that in there. Move on to Hunger Games. Tati, do you want to start off with what you think?
Sure.
Added to the female sci-fi action genre?
So Hunger Games, as we probably know, based on a young adult novel that stars a woman in the first place. And so we get, it's, you know, a new generation of girls got to see themselves as the action hero, right? Katniss became a super popular rebirth of an archetype as well as a costume. But it's interesting that so much hoopla is made out of the unnecessary love triangle that was introduced into the story for, I don't know why, because there was no reason for a love triangle.
Because it was like building off of the Twilight archetype.
Exactly. Yeah. That's yeah.
And
Twilight is also building off of Buffy. Now we know. Thank you, Buffy. Mm-hmm. even though one of them was a werewolf, it's still the same idea. So, yes. So, like, you can argue whether Katniss is actually a well-written character, you know, an actual heroine in her own right, or if she's just an empty shell in the vein of Bella Swan. That's what I was going to say.
An empty swan.
but... The point is that she made a lot of little white girls feel powerful. And that has carried through to future successful action sci-fi flicks and series.
A lot of like little white girls feel powerful.
Yes! Yes! we wouldn't have the 100 on the CW right now if it was not for Katniss. And we probably wouldn't have the false impression of Ship Wars on the 100 if not for Katniss. Because the 100 has very few ships, and yet people have made huge amount of shipping fodder out of non-canon relationships. But anyway, that's what I was going to say. The writing of the 100 doesn't even focus on ships, and yet that's the thing that the fandom focuses the most on. Or at least based on the output that you see from that fandom, you would think that that's what they most care about. And like we mentioned, Twilight, which was the precursor of Hunger Games, but also gave way to The Vampire Diaries on the CW, where once again we have a woman who is supposed to be the center of the story, ostensibly the star of the show, Bella and Elena Gilbert, and yet story is really all about which dude can love her best. And best obviously means the most controlling, damaging, and unrealistic way possible, which I guess, nope, still the same. Nope, because I was going to make an argument for how PETA is great, but nope, because PETA is engineering the entire fake romance in the game without actually telling Katniss any of it. So it's the same. It's all the same. I don't know how I feel about this, but there is like a,
that seems, you know, like more like a regression than, or like a,
there's like a surface level girl power to the stories.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which is kind of interesting.
Mm-hmm. But by making it, like, by positioning it as a love triangle, it becomes a battle over which dude deserves the girl more. So I would suggest no more love triangles, so that it is no more battles of deserving. Because love is not about which character inspires your pity more and therefore deserves the female as a prize.
That's interesting to me, because, like, with the Hunger Games, those, that aspect of it was, like, the least interesting to me. But, I mean, Katniss, for me, was, like, definitely proof that women can continue to lead sci-fi flicks and be successful, especially, like, off the success of Harry Potter, where we had Hermione, but she wasn't, like, the leading, you know, she wasn't the title character.
She should have been.
Yeah, no, I agree. And, I mean, we can argue whether she was well-written or not, but I do think that Katniss represented the opposite of the kind of woman usually written by men. Like, she had many feelings, but she internalized them, and I feel like she got a lot of hate for that, because, and she wasn't, like, quirky, and she didn't seem to care much about, like, the love triangle herself until, like, the very end, or, like, the third book, really. But she did definitely pave the way for the 100, and also the divergence of the YA to screen world. And I sense it for Twilight. I feel like it was a step backwards in the portrayal of women, because, and their place in the romances, and the portrayal of destructive and awful romances, in order to preserve female purity or whatever. And, like, I can't speak for Vampire Diaries because I've never seen it, but there was clearly a lot of man pain in Twilight, and it focused more on Edward and was essentially the guide to what an unhealthy, abusive relationship looks like.
It's kind of funny because, like, you know, as we've been going through this kind of evolution, it does feel like, in a way, that it's regressed a little bit with... It's Twilight's fault. Twilight did this to us with the whole, like, love triangle thing, and, like, you know, some kind of weird way to elevate Bella's purity or whatever, and how these stories are supposed to be, like, female action-led stories are... more, like, the fandom focuses more on, like, the shipping part of it, and that's what it becomes, more so than the woman herself doing something. So it's kind of, I kind of feel the same way about racial diversity, because I feel like the 90s was a hell of a lot more diverse on TV than the 2000s, and, like, what it is now, which is kind of, like, really weird when you look at it. It's kind of like you're stepping backwards instead of forwards. So we're in, it is kind of like a weird space for, there's like this fakeness of feminism and female empowerment, but it's based on, or like sitting on top of, like, the basis, the foundation of that show is, or the, of those shows is based on which man gets to have the girl kind of thing. So that's weird.
Like May pointed out, like, Katniss is written mostly for herself, and not mostly, like, she doesn't really care about the love triangle. She doesn't really care about Peeta until the end of the first book. And it's not like she's actually weighing Peeta versus Galen in her mind. And yet that is what fans choose to focus on when watching a reading, because if you're given in the opening, right, you make a whole mountain out of a molehill. Mm-hmm. That's mixing metaphors, but... Give an inch, they take a mile. There you go. I'll just go with that one.
Mm. And then I think our last section, if you've stuck through us with this walk down sci-fi memory lane, we get to more of the comic side. Women are superheroes too. So, you know, we've talked about Wonder Woman and briefly mentioned Captain Marvel, that movie that's coming out. But also with the success of Wonder Woman movie, now we are starting to see more emphasis on some female-led movies, including more female leading roles in comic movies, such as Captain Marvel movies coming out. But you also have, Black Widow that's never gotten her own film, but she counts because she's an Avenger. And you've got Black Panther, most recently, had a lot of female influence, strong female influence, with Okoye and Shuri and Lupita Nyong'o.
Nakia.
Nakia. And then, like, his mom is...
We don't remember any of her characters' names. There's always Lupita Nyong'o.
We don't remember any of Lupita's characters. We just know she's in the movie. Just kidding.
Maz Kanata. Her name in Star Wars is Maz Kanata.
Oh, okay. Well, there you
did
go.
Did they ever actually say her name in the movie?
Yes. They do. Oh. Yes, they do. Okay. And then with Thor Ragnarok, with Valkyrie. So, like, a lot of, like, Marvel is, Captain Marvel will be their first female-led movie, but they do include, like, a lot of strong women. Storm with X-Men in their movies, and even on Netflix with Jessica Jones, Daisy Johnson, Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., and Melinda May, I think, yeah. And then with DC, well, I guess we'll start with Marvel, so y'all are bigger Marvel fans than I am, so if y'all want to expand on any of that, go ahead.
All the words that you said are true. What I find interesting about Marvel is that they've put out 19 mostly successful films so far. and you know, like, there was The Incredible Hulk, and Thor at the Dark World, so some of them have been missteps. But in general, 19 successful, well-received films, and yet they had, in all of those, they did not have a single title female character, right? So when you have a universe that large, like we were talking about Star Trek earlier, right, which was series, but like, in one season, Star Trek had more important women than Marvel had in 19 movies, which seems insane. But thank God for Black Panther, because before that, we did not have more than two women in one movie, and certainly not more than two women talking to each other and having dynamics that did not revolve around the hero in that moment. So, and of course, we didn't have Black women before 2018, bless you, in the Marvel universe.
Invented yet.
Yeah, before 2017. But yes, like, they came to fruition. They sprang from, you know, Athena or whatever in Spider-Man Homecoming, and then got to be actual heroes and, you know, action ladies in Thor Ragnarok and Black Panther. So thank God for that. But anyway, and obviously Zoe Saldana exists, but was always covered in green paint, so she doesn't count.
I'll say, like, quickly about Ragnarok, the one thing that I really loved is that, first of all, Valkyrie was bisexual, which was a great shot of diversity in sexual orientation into comic movie universe. But also, I loved how much Thor loved Valkyrie, and, like, he was, like, fangirling over her and, like, oh, this is awesome, because it's not something that you would typically think. He's, like, the lead male comic hero, so, like, for him to fangirl over her was, I thought, a really great just way to show, you know, appreciation for her as her own warrior, and kind of validated her status as to be, like, on par. Like, he thinks that she's above him. So, like, yeah, that was really great to see.
Yeah, and I feel like that's also a nod towards, or just, like, Thor Ragnarok was as good as it was, not just in terms of being a good movie, but also in terms of being one where we get to see that kind of dynamic or that kind of position that we wouldn't otherwise have seen because of taking a chance on a smaller director, if you will, right? Like, Taika Waititi is not the director that you would have imagined for a Thor movie, and yet he made the best, most comprehensive, funniest, and most, you know, progressive of all of them. So, and going back to diversity behind the scenes as well, like, obviously he's a man of color, he's Aboriginal, but, or Maori, but he also, because they're filming in Australia, right? And we've sort of talked before about Australia being super big on racism as well. But he made a point to hire Aboriginal people for behind the scenes. And, you know, like, all the trash people that wanted to kill Thor too. So he also hired, like, a big amount of Aboriginal extras as well, in order to make sure that, you know, he was hiring Australians for the Australian film. But yeah, so that's kind of stuff that you don't normally hear about on things, you know, on Marvel sets, until, of course, Black Panther. But on the TV side, or actually, do you want to say stuff about the movies first, May?
I mean, I was just going to say basically all of what you said. There's, I mean, there's not much to add.
The TV side is where Marvel has actually been making leaps and bounds while the movies took 10 years to do it. Because we had, obviously, Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., which gave us, not only is an Asian female showrunner, you know, as part of a duo, but still. We have an Asian woman as a showrunner, and two Asian women as regulars, with Chloe Bennett and Ming-Na Wen playing Daisy Johnson and Melinda May. And as the show expanded, you know, as the seasons went on, we get more and more amazing women. And now we also have Natalia Cordova-Buckley playing Elena Rodriguez. So it's just all the females on the show right now. All the regulars are women of color. So, yay.
Yeah. I mean, I did have, well, it's like minor to add, but I do think it's completely ridiculous that every Avenger got their own movie, except the only woman female Avenger. And the fact that Black Panther had black women be active in the plot and action was just amazing. And it said a lot about it being the first black superhero. And then you have all these amazing women in this movie. And then since TV has always been ahead of movies in a little bit more diversity, at least. So this is why I think we got the first Asian hero and lead character for Marvel on TV. And they've had better female characters overall on that show versus the MCU, which is just now catching up. So they can jump on the diversity train because it makes you money, guys. You know, more money.
Yeah. One thing that I will say about Black Panther is that I like that his T'Challa's guards, like his first regent military, is like women, all women. And it's kind of like, you know, how, you know, women are like the foundation of like the black family, and the fact that the people that he chooses to protect his life, and that the country has always chosen to protect the life of the king, the most important man in the kingdom, have been women, and they are seen as warriors. I think it's just like, you know, something that's just like a really great representation and part of like the comic history. But then finally, within the next 10 minutes, we are going to discuss the DC part, because I have to go to the gym.
I'm getting leg cramps. We've been talking this long.
Yeah. For like women being superheroes in the DC universe, there are so many like female characters in the comic canon, like women superheroes, not just Wonder Woman. I feel like Wonder Woman gets the most recognition because she's the Trinity, but she's also, mm-hmm. you know, when you think about even like DC TV and like film media, we're just now getting to see some of the other female superheroes come to the forefront on TV. So you've got Supergirl with Kara, then with Arrow, when they introduced, they kind of messed up their introduction of Black Canary with Sarah at first, but then finally getting Laurel her mantle as Black Canary. And then Sarah moving over to Legends of Tomorrow. You've got Black Lightning now, with Thunder and Lightning coming on to the series. And so we're now not even only just more DC women superheroes on TV in general, but also more diversity. You've got Superhero Girls, which is like an animated series. You've got Young Justice, which is coming back now. You've got Teen Titans Go. I think there's a lot of like Bumblebee, and yes. She's in like Young Justice, and she's in Superhero Girls. But you know, outside of that, there's not a lot of promotion. I think there could be more. Like Vixen, I think they had a chance to have on, give her a higher profile than she has had in like the larger general audience viewing arena as far as on TV. But then they debuted her as an animated series instead of just debuting her as an actual character, and then the actress that they chose to play Vixen got tied up in, I don't want to do this anymore. It seems like she didn't want to like commit to it.
Yeah.
But now we can't even have
Vixen animated. I mean, at least we have her on Legends, but it's a different Vixen.
But it's a different. So I feel like I definitely feel like there's more that they could be doing to include more women of color superheroes on the shows, especially because they have the fan base for it in the comics. You just don't really see it as much on TV. So that, I think that's what I would like to see more of, really.
I mean, I agree with this. I don't have much to add in particular. I just think that it's, as usual, it's interesting to see the reaction to, like, even when people cry for feminism and that they want more feminism, it's interesting to see the reaction that they have when that feminism is more intersectional or more diverse. But I'm glad that we are getting more female heroes to choose from, and not just female superheroes, but getting more characters who are civilian, so that we can see ways that women, you know, regular women like us, can still be heroes in a world where there are superheroes.
Yeah. I mean, I've said this before, but even though there's a long way to go and several improvements to be made, I feel like DC TV is the best group of comics to screen media with regards to diversity with women, at least way more than the DCEU has done, which is very, very minimal, if at all, actually. And I know Kiersey Clemons will be the first Black woman in the movies to play Iris, thanks in large part to Candace being able to open that door. And on TV, I think Legends and Flash, at least going into season 5, are the best right now in terms of women of color. Like, for Flash, they need to have women interact more. Give us, you know, Iris more female friendships with Cecile and Nora and a friend outside Star Labs. But, like, having 3 Black or biracial women is a big step. And Black Lightning gave us the first Black superheroes on TV. And Anissa being a Black lesbian superhero is, like, a big step in the right direction. So I feel like there's always improvements to be made, but I feel like they've taken a much bigger steps than other types of media in this genre.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that. They, like, to go further, especially with Anissa on Black Lightning, I would actually like to see them incorporate her sexual orientation more in an organic way, and not just have it, you know, it's great that they didn't
Thunder
have
Grace
attention to it through a whole coming out story, but I would still like to see it part of her, like, day-to-day. So, like, yeah, definitely bringing, like, Grace back and actually developing that relationship, which I'm hopeful that we'll get to see in season 2. And then Grace coming in with her own powers as well. So there is a lot that is out there, but just needs to be pushed a little bit more, I think. And I think, did anyone want to mention Smallville? Or
I feel like you're going to walk right out the door, so we can probably skip.
Yeah. We can do like a special episode on Smallville one of these days. We will actually rewatch it. Yeah. So we've got to do other, there'll be other specials coming up, like the unaired Wonder Woman pilot and Aquaman pilot. Smallville, maybe Constantine one day.
And then next week we'll be discussing the Love Boat series.
Yes!
So we finally can do that now. That is the end of our evolution of women in sci-fi genre. Thank you for taking this walk down sci-fi memory lane with us. We'll be back, as we said, next week with the Love Boat series part 4, so you can see if your ships have sailed and become stronger into battleships, or they sank in the, like, water graveyard below. So we'll see you next week.
Bye.